Have a seat. Good to see you today. Man, it is a beautiful day, like the sun is out. From in here, looking out the window, you might think that it's summer until you open those doors and go out there and experience it. But man, good to see you today, and we're going to have just a great time today. We've got an excellent story to look at today. Everybody loves a good rags-to-riches story, right? Especially in America. That's kind of the fabric of our nation. You know, my kids are learning American history, and, you know, they love stories of things like, you know, Abraham Lincoln, where he's born and, you know, and raised in a single-room log cabin and grew up to become president of the United States of America. You know, we love stories of things like John D. Rockefeller, who's born into a normal family and is a self-made man and goes on to just amass this huge amount of wealth. Or even better, if there's a story of like an immigrant who comes to this country with nothing, and it's nothing but their own hard work and ingenuity that helps them make a name for themselves. And in fact, our country is kind of based on that whole narrative, that it doesn't matter what kind of family that you are born into, that if you just, you know, work hard enough and have enough grit, you can go wherever you want in life. We just love a rags-to-riches story. And that's what we have today, except the opposite. Today is actually a riches-to-rags story. In Genesis 37, we're going to look at the life of Joseph, and we are going to see a guy who is born with everything, and yet by the end of the story, he's a slave. But the message of the story is that even when it looked like Joseph lost everything, he didn't lose everything because God was still with him. Is God with us in tragedies? If your life does not look like a rags-to-riches story, is God still with you? Is God with you when your kids suffer illness? Is God with you when you lose your job? Is God with you when your marriage falls apart? Is God with you when you lose your spouse? Well, he is. He is. He doesn't always feel like he is, but he is. And so, over the next 2 weeks, we're going to continue talking about the life of Joseph, and we're going to see Joseph just go through some terrible things. He loses everything. But throughout everything, throughout the whole story, God is with him. And so if you're here today and you've lost something or you've lost someone, I hope that by the end of our time together that you will realize that God is with you. He's with you still. Now, we pick up the story, like I said, in Genesis 37. We're going to start in verse 12. But Genesis is Latin for beginnings. And if you've read the book of Genesis, you know that it's all about beginnings. Yes, the very beginning of the book, it's about the beginning of the world. But most of it is about the beginning of the Jewish nation, right? 39 of the 50 chapters of Genesis are about the beginning of the nation of Israel. And so when we pick up the story today, and we're in chapter 37, we have seen Jacob just show intense favoritism to Joseph, and then his son Joseph. And this is encapsulated with him giving him this coat of many colors. And the coat would have been a symbol that he was the favorite son, and it just infuriated his brothers. And the text says that his brothers hated him so much, it says they couldn't even speak a word of peace to him. And this is where we pick up the story in verse 12 of Genesis chapter 37. So let's read the first couple verses here. Are going to set the stage. They're going to give us a setting for the drama that's going to happen in these chapters. So let's read verses 12 through 14. It says, "Now his brothers went to pasture in their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph," Israel is Jacob, by the way, same guy, "are not your brothers pasturing in the flock at Shechem? Come, I'll send you to them." And he said to him, "Here I am." And so he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word." And so he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. All right, I'll stop there. Okay, so like I said, these first couple verses, they set the drama for this story that's about to take place. Jacob says to his son Joseph, he's like, hey, aren't your brothers out in Shechem pasturing the flocks? Why don't you go check on them? Now, what are we struck with immediately? Just right at the beginning of the story, what sticks out to us? Well, what's that? Joseph's not working, right? Thank you for calling out. I like that. It wasn't a rhetorical question, but Joseph's not working. Jacob, all of his brothers are out in the field, and Joseph is at home with his dad. Remember, Gary mentioned last week that this was kind of the symbol of the coat of many colors. It wasn't just a fancy coat. Like, it had long sleeves. It was super impractical for working in. And the symbol of the coat was that you, Joseph, are favored and privileged. You're not going to have to work, whereas all your brothers are. The coat of many colors is kind of like the ancient Near Eastern equivalent of like a Star Wars Snuggie, okay? And that actually exists, by the way. Can we get an image of it? There it is. Now, I would totally wear one of these, but I wouldn't wear it to work, okay? And that was kind of the point of the coat of many colors. And that was really fancy, too. Like, it was ornate, made of good materials. You could tell that a wealthy person would wear this and not to work in. By the way, the Snuggie is also available in Darth Vader, not just Chewbacca. But not something that you'd work in, something that you'd watch Netflix in. And so Joseph, this is a symbol that he's not going to have to work. And sure enough, in these verses, we see this playing out, that his brothers are out in the field working. He's at home with his dad, relaxing, hanging out. Now, the text says that Joseph is in the Valley of Hebron, and Jacob's in the Valley of Hebron, and his sons are at Shechem, which is about 50 miles away. Here's a map. You can see Hebron. It's same perspective. Yeah, bottom right, you can kind of see it in big letters there, and then Shechem is just north of it. That's about a 50-mile trip there. Jacob's boys are 50 miles away with the flock. And remember, in the ancient world, your goats and your sheep and your animals, that's kind of like your bank account. I mean, this is all of his wealth and his business. Everything is 50 miles away with the boys. Why would they be 50 miles away from their dad with all of his stuff? Maybe because they were up to no good. Remember in the last section we saw that they were up to no good, and Joseph went and saw what they were doing, brought a bad report back to their dad. Maybe they're up to their old tricks again, and they're like, well, this time we're just going to go really far away. That way Joseph can't come see what we're doing and snitch back on dad. Who knows? It doesn't say why they were that far away, but they were 50 miles away in Shechem. And Shechem is also significant because Jacob had lived there earlier in his life. Chapter 34 of Genesis actually takes place in Shechem. That's where the family was living at the time. And it's a terrible chapter. In Genesis 34, Jacob's daughter Dinah is raped by a guy named Shechem that this town is actually named after. He's the prince of the town. And you may remember, you know, if you've read the story or Gary mentioned it last week, that Jacob doesn't do anything. He doesn't pursue justice for her. He just kind of lets it go. And because of that, Dinah's brothers, they decide that they are going to take the law in their own hands. And so Shechem decides he wants to marry Dinah. And so her brothers say to Shechem's dad, they're like, well, we can't let our sister marry you guys. Culturally, it's just not appropriate unless all of you get circumcised. Like, your whole clan has to do it. And they say, okay, well, I guess we can do that. So they all undergo the operation. And then it says 3 days later, when all the men were sore, these guys go out and they kill everyone. They kill all the men and they steal all their stuff. And so the rest of the inhabitants, the ones that live in like the surrounding communities and villages, they're understandably concerned because they don't know who this guy Jacob is or his family. And they're like, you know, we understand that you wanted justice, but this wasn't justice. This was revenge and an escalation of violence. Like, who are you people? And Jacob says to his sons, he's like, why did you do this? I think the words he says is, we've now become a stench in the nostrils of the people who live here. And so Jacob's like, we gotta move on. We can't stay here anymore. So now, years later, the boys go back there, and they're 50 miles away. They've got all of Jacob's wealth and all his animals, and they're in the neighborhood where Jacob knows they're not welcome. So he gets a little nervous, and he says, Joseph, why don't you go check on your brothers, make sure everything's okay? So let's see what happens to him, and spoiler alert, it's not good. Starting in verse 15. So Joseph's going to meet a guy on the way there. That's what's happening here in verse 15, some random guy. And a man found him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." And the man said, "Oh, they've gone away, and I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. That's like another 12 miles down the road. They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Oh, here comes that dreamer. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and then we'll say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we'll see what becomes of his dreams." All right, we'll stop there. So Joseph eventually finds his brothers in Dothan, and it says that they recognized him from a long way off. Well, how did they recognize him? The coat, right? They recognize that Star Wars Snuggie from anywhere, right? Now they see the coat and they're like, "Oh, here comes that dreamer." Remember, he had the dreams where he said, "You guys are all one day going to bow down and show me honor." And they're like, "Oh, here comes that dreamer." And they come up with a plan. They're like, "Let's kill him and we'll tell Dad that some wild animal ate him, you know, and then we'll see what happens with his dreams." Before we go any further, I do want to take some time and pause and think about just for a moment, the difference between Joseph's situation with regards to his perception of where he is right now versus the reality of where Joseph is right now, right? I want to take the difference between, talk about the difference between Joseph's perceptions and reality. What is Joseph's perception? Well, from Joseph's perspective, life is good, right? Like, he's like, I'm my dad's favorite. I got everything I ever want. I got this fancy coat. Life looks good. The future is bright. Everything is going well. You know, he's even been given this special task by his dad to go find out what's going on with his brothers and give a report. So from Joseph's perspective, the future is bright. But what is reality? Reality is he's as good as dead. Right? His brothers, they have already made a concrete plan. They have action steps of how they're going to kill him, how they're going to cover it up. They're like, we'll throw him in a pit. We'll say a wild animal did it. Nobody will be the wiser. And so Joseph's perception is different than reality. Does that make sense? You're tracking with me so far? He thinks life is good. Really, life is not good. He's as good as dead. Now, how often does that happen to us? Right? We think we have a firm grasp on reality that, you know, things couldn't be better, that life is good, that the future looks bright, when in reality, you know, we're completely unaware of problems in our marriage or that the company is planning on letting us go. Things like that happen all the time. Like, we think life is going well, and behind the scenes, we don't even realize it, and things are not going well. I saw on the news, I think it was either yesterday or the day before, that, the Walmart company just suddenly decided they were going to close all these Sam's Club stores. And so it was just kind of a sudden and unexpected thing. Now, from the employee's perspective, like, one day things are going really well, and then the next day it's like, hey, we're closing up shop. And it would have been a huge surprise to them, but in reality, those plans had probably been in place for a long time. They just didn't know. And terrible things like that, you know, they surprise us all the time. We just don't even know what's going on. Right now, there could be something going on brewing in your life that you don't even know about. And I don't say that to scare you, but, you know, as we're going to see further in the text, but just to point out that there's always things going on that we just don't see. And Joseph, right here, his perception of reality isn't accurate. He had no idea that he was a dead man. He thought everything was peachy. He thought life was good. He thought that the future was bright. But God saves his life. And that's what we're going to get to in verse 21. Let's read verses 21 through 24. It says, "But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, 'Well, let's not take his life.' And Reuben said to them, 'Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him.'" And Reuben is thinking that he might rescue him out of their hands and restore him to his father. And so when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and they threw him into a pit. And the pit was empty. There was no water in it. All right. So Joseph, he's about to be murdered by his brothers. And all of a sudden, one of his brothers, Reuben, speaks up and he's like, whoa, hey guys, wait, let's not shed his blood. Let's just throw him into this cistern that's here. Let's put aside for a second Reuben's plan to save him later, because he doesn't appeal to that, and his brothers aren't thinking that at all. But in case his solution seems compassionate, know that this thing that they want to throw him into, my translation says pit, some of them say like a well, it was probably a cistern. And in the ancient Near East, you know, a cistern was something that was underground and shaped kind of like a bottle. So you'd have like a long, thin, like a shaft, and then it would open up at the bottom, and it would collect rainwater, and then you could get water out of it. But the text says that there's no water in it at this time. And so when Joseph is thrown into it, like there's no way. He'd have to be, you've seen those guys at like the rock climbing gyms that have like the master rock climbing skill. That would be the only way that he could get out. It's not going to happen for him. He's down there and he's never getting out. I do have a couple pictures of ancient cisterns. This is a cistern in the Middle East. Can we get another one here? Yeah, so this is what it looked like. This is what they threw him into. Just this a hole in the ground. He's never going to get out of it. Now, when we do sermon series artwork, we've got that Joseph picture thing. We use this site called designcontest.com, and I go on there and I write like a little write-up of what the sermon series is going to be about and what kind of image we're looking for the series. And we get these designers all over the world that submit designs, and we go through and we pick which one we like the best. And we get a lot of good ones, but we get a lot of them that are not very good. And I've wanted to do this for a long time, share with you one of the not good ones. And I do have one for this one. This is one of the not good ones. There you go. So I considered this one, but then I thought it would probably be better not to use an image that was going to give everybody nightmares for the rest of their life, right? So you're welcome for that. You can't unsee that picture. But, you know, thrown in that cistern, he's got no food, no water, it's in the middle of the wilderness, no one is going to hear him scream. He is as good as dead in a couple of days. And so Reuben, his brother, is like, let's not shed his blood, let's throw him in this cistern in the middle of the wilderness, no food or water, no hope of escape, and no one to help him out. And, you know, if he dies, well, that's on him, right? That's not our fault if he dies. But Reuben's concern is not for Joseph's well-being. The brothers are concerned about this whole idea of shedding blood. Whoa, that was crazy. Also unplanned. So the brothers here, they're not thinking that this is like having compassion on Joseph. They're more concerned about this whole idea of shedding blood. And what does this go back to? This goes back to Genesis 4 and the story of Cain and Abel. In Genesis 4, Cain, he kills his brother Abel and he tries to hide the crime from God and from his family. But God, he knows what Cain has done, and he tells him in Genesis 4, 10 through 11, it says, "And the Lord said, 'What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand.'" And so Joseph's brothers, they know this story. And they know that when Cain shed his brother's blood, that his blood cried out from the ground to God. And God says, you know, you can't hide from me these crimes. You can't hide from me injustice. And so the brothers' decision not to, you know, shed Joseph's blood then and there was not so much an act of compassion. It was an act to try to find a loophole in God's justice, right? And they say, well, if we shed his blood, God is going to hold us accountable. But if we throw him in a pit with no food and water, no chance of escape, no one to rescue him, and in a couple of days he just happens to die, that's his fault, not ours. We're not the ones that killed him. Now, in case you're wondering, that is not how God works, right? There's no loopholes like that in his justice. Now, the point I'm trying to make with all of this passage is, you know, how has Joseph's situation, as we're tracking with him through this story, how has his situation changed both with regard to his perception of reality and actual reality. Okay? From Joseph's perspective, he starts the scene and life is good. Future's bright, he's the favorite son, you know, he's just excited. And now all of a sudden, he's thrown in a cistern and he's like, wow, this is terrible. What happened to me? You know, where is God in all of this? But that's just his perception, right? In reality, life was not good, right? In reality, he was as good as dead. His brothers, they had concrete plans to murder him and cover it up. He was a dead man. And then when he's in the cistern, he's not in a good place, but at least he's had his life extended by a couple of days. He's as good as dead, but he's not dead yet. So from Joseph's perspective, he's wondering, like, how could God let this happen to me? I mean, things were going so well. I got the coat. My dad loves me more than my brothers. Things are, you know, and now all of a sudden, you know, how could God let this happen to me? Where is God in all of this? Where was God in all of this? Well, do we think it is a coincidence that right at the moment of truth, when the brothers are just going to murder him, right at that moment, all of a sudden, Reuben thinks about Genesis 4 and Cain and Abel and says, hey guys, let's not shed his blood. Do we think that was just a coincidence? No. God intervened and reminded him that they could not hide injustice from God. So because of God's intervention, Joseph is spared here, you know, at least temporarily. Now, he's eventually going to die of exposure down in that cistern, but at least he's had about 48 hours or whatever added to his life. So his brothers, you know, from their take on things, they've essentially killed him. Like, he's not dead yet. He's going to live a couple more days. But they've essentially killed their brother. Let's see what they do next. Verse 25. It says, then they sat down to eat. They sat down and had lunch. Like, it doesn't even say that they, like, went a mile away or even, like, 100 yards away or going somewhere where they can't hear him scream. They just sat down and they broke out their thermoses and their sandwiches and had lunch. I mean, that is some serious hate there. Some serious hate. But God was with Joseph, because let's see what happens next. Let's pick it back up in 25. It says, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. And when Judah said to his brothers, hey, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. And then the Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up, and they lifted him out of the pit, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. So Joseph's brothers, they're just, you know, casually sitting down, having lunch, eating their sandwiches and drinking their coffee, and all of a sudden these Ishmaelites come by on their way to Egypt, and Judah has this great idea. He's like, hey, you know, we got an opportunity to make some money here. If we kill Joseph, we don't get anything from it, but if we sell him to slavery, we could make a couple pieces of silver. And so, you know, and he's like, after all, he is our brother, all of a sudden prick of conscience there. But that's what they decide to do. They pull him out of the cistern and they sell him into slavery. Now, let's go back through the story again. Progression, perception versus reality. Joseph, from his perception, his perspective, life is good, favorite son, coat of many colors, future looks bright. Life is terrible, I'm in the cistern, I'm gonna die. To now, life's still bad, but at least I'm not going to die. That's his perception. But what's reality? He's dead, is where he started. He was as good as dead. His brothers were going to murder him. To now, he's in the cistern, still probably going to die, but at least he's going to live a little bit longer. To he's alive. He's not going to die. He's in slavery, and he's heading to Egypt. Again, from God's perspective, okay, the reality, do we think it was just a coincidence that the Ishmaelites came by right when they did, right when the brothers were sitting down to have lunch? Do we think that was just a coincidence? Again, we can see after the fact, we can look and we can see how God was intervening in all of these things, and he was with Joseph in all of it. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Joseph's story, I'm going to spoil it for you because it's the only way to help me make my point with this message. So after this, Joseph, he's taken to Egypt, and he has a pretty rough go at it in Egypt. I mean, things get worse before they get better. But eventually, life turns around, Joseph rises in the ranks, and before he knows it, Joseph is like second in command over all of the nation. The only person he's under is Pharaoh himself. And it's at that time where there is this famine in the land, and everybody in the whole world is like starving, except the people in Egypt. And Jacob, miles away, he finds out that there's grain in Egypt, and so he says to his sons, like, hey, you need to go to Egypt and see if we can get some food from the Egyptians. So we've got these parallel stories going on, and we've seen Joseph rise in the ranks, and now, lo and behold, who is in charge of Pharaoh's grain distribution network but Joseph? And so here are his brothers. They're coming, and there's like a collision course of what is going to happen when they meet each other again. And the climax of the story is when Jacob's sons have to go to Egypt to ask for help, and they stand before this powerful Egyptian that has the power to give them food or not, and they don't even realize that it's the same brother that they tried to kill all those years earlier. And that is the image that we actually did go with, not the one that's going to haunt your nightmares forever. But you see Joseph here, he's wearing the Egyptian garb, and then those are his brothers around him, just like he said in his dream. He said, one day you guys are going to give me honor. And that's what they're doing in the image. Now, this is kind of the climax of the story, but the story does not resolve at this point. Yes, Joseph forgives his brothers. There's a peace there, but there's still the question of whether this is a real peace, of whether this is just a faux peace or a temporary peace. And we don't find out until the very end of the story. The book of Genesis ends with Jacob dying, and when Jacob dies, his brothers, all of a sudden, like, they panic a little bit because they're like, okay, now that dad is dead, is there going to be a day of reckoning? Like, is Joseph going to go all like Michael Corleone on us and like settle all the family business now that mom and dad are both dead? And they fear for their lives because they thought maybe Joseph's just being nice to us because of dad. So in chapter 50, they go and they just fall before Joseph and basically beg for their lives. And Joseph says to them in Genesis 50, 19 through 21, he says, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I'll provide for you and your little ones. And thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Now remember, I said that Genesis is about beginnings. It's about the beginning of the world, but more importantly, or more so, it's about the beginning of a people, the people of Israel. And the book of Genesis begins with God creating the world, and when he's creating the world, he doesn't need help creating things. He says, let there be light, and there's light. When God makes something, he has the power to make it. He has the power to bring it about with or without help along the way. When he says something's going to happen, it's going to happen. Then we get to chapter 12, and God says to Abraham, I am going to make you a father of a great nation. And the next 38 chapters are about God doing just that. And we know, as we read the story, we know that when God says he's going to make something, he's going to make it. And he doesn't need help. He doesn't need anyone's help in doing that. He didn't need help making the world, and he doesn't need help making a nation. And it's a good thing, too, because he doesn't get a lot of help along the way. I mean, we've seen in this story that Jacob's sons, I mean, they do everything within their power to kind of ruin this for God. They try to do everything they can to be evil, and yet God uses it for good. And the point of the story is that nothing can thwart the purposes of God. Not the forces of nature, not powerful people of this world, not sin, not demons, not the devil himself, not even us with our failures and our shortcomings can thwart God's purposes for our life. Now, we don't always know God's plan. plans for our life. You know, in chapter 37, you know, Joseph, he didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. You know, he didn't realize that when he was in the cistern, God was working. He didn't realize that when he was sold into slavery, that God was working. And by faith, we affirm that God is working even when we're in the cistern. I love how Philip Yancey describes this. In his book, Reaching for the Invisible God, Philip Yancey talks about faith in the midst of hardships. And it's kind of a weird image that he uses, but it works. He says that faith is the opposite of paranoia. And bear with me here, because I like how he puts it. But this is Philip Yancey. He says, I once met a bona fide paranoid, a young woman who was utterly convinced that the world was against her. Whatever happened, she somehow worked it into her conspiracy theory of a hostile world. If I tried to comfort her by saying something like, you know, I think you took that comment the wrong way. Martha was just trying to be helpful. She doesn't hate you. My peacemaking would only fuel her paranoia. Aha, he's one of them. Martha probably put him up to this. He's trying to soften me up, break down my resistance. Nothing anyone said or did could pierce through her protective armor of paranoia. Now, Philip Yancey continues, a paranoid person orients life around fear. My wife worked for a supervisor who became convinced wrongly that Janet had eyes on his job. So every suggestion Janet made at work, her supervisor took as an attempt to undermine him. Every compliment he took as a subversive attempt to win him over. Nothing Janet said could convince him otherwise, and eventually she had to leave her job to preserve her own sanity. Now Yancey, he goes on to say, I'm learning that mature faith, which encompasses both simple faith and fidelity, works the opposite of paranoia. It reassembles all of the events of life around trust in a loving God. When good things happen, I accept them as gifts from God, worthy of thanksgiving. And when bad things happen, I don't necessarily take them as sent by God. I see evidence in the Bible to the contrary, and I find in them no reason to divorce God. But rather, I trust that God can use even those bad things for my benefit. And thus, at least, is the goal to which I strive. Now, Philip Yancey concludes, a faithful person sees life from the perspective of trust, not fear. Bedrock faith allows me to believe that despite the chaos of the present moment, God does reign. That regardless of how worthless I may feel, I truly matter to a God of love. That no pain lasts forever and no evil triumphs in the end. Faith sees that even the darkest deed of all of history, the death of God's Son, as a necessary prelude to the brightest. And I like that. Even history's greatest crime can be used by God to accomplish his purposes. Now, this does not logically imply that God like afflicts us in order to accomplish his will. But the scriptures are, you know, the scriptures are clear that there are forces of evil out there that are warring against us and are working against the will of God. What it does mean is that even when these forces give us their worst, that God turns that back on their heads and uses that to accomplish his purposes. That's why Joseph says, you meant it for evil. And he doesn't say like, it's not a big deal or what you did wasn't so bad. He calls him out. He's like, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And I like how Yancey says we have this posture of embracing that even when life doesn't make sense to us. So how do we do that? How do we maintain this posture of faith? Well, with habit and liturgy. And what I mean by that, world-class athletes, they train themselves for proper form by going through the motions of their sport like over and over, and you look at Olympic athletes like swimmers and gymnasts and stuff, they just go over and over and over again until it is just ingrained in their brain and it's habit and they don't have to think about it. And then when they're on the big stage and everybody's watching them and the pressure is on and they're nervous, they don't have to think about it because it's habit and it's just a part of them, and it just comes out automatic. In the same way, we immerse ourselves in the stories of the Bible. And we immerse ourselves in the symbols of faith, of Christ's body broken for us, of Christ's blood poured out for us. And we immerse ourselves in the words of faith through songs that remind us of the gospel. And we do that over and over again so that when we're under pressure and when things don't make sense, when we have doubts, when we don't believe, we don't have to think about it. It's automatic. It's just become a part of who we are. It's because we believe deep down inside at an unconscious level that God is good and that he's working behind the scenes for our good. Now, before we end, I do want to summarize the last seven verses, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on them. You can read them on your own. The story ends with Joseph's brothers. They kill an animal. They dip Joseph's coat in blood. And they go back to their dad, and they're like, "Oh, your son was killed by this wild animal," and he believes them, and he just starts wailing. He just breaks down. He loses it. And if this story sounds familiar, it's because it's very similar to what Jacob himself did when he was a young man. You remember he took that sheepskin thing and he put it on his arm and tricked his dad into blessing him instead of Esau. And now his boys kind of do the same thing to him. His boys are just like him, as Harry Chapin might have said. Now, in a moment, the band's going to come back up, and we're going to transition to our response time. We have a couple more songs to sing. We're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper. If you're new here and you don't know what to do, that's okay. Just know that you are free to come forward if you want. If that's uncomfortable to you, know that you're also free to remain where you are, but you might have to let somebody else get by. But while we sing and while we celebrate the Lord's Supper, I'd also love to pray for you. I'll be standing back there in that corner to do that. Dick Teodoro will be back there in that corner. He'd love to pray for you as well. So if there's anything going on, big or small, we'd love to pray for you. But before we transition to the response time, I do want to point out one more thing. In John chapter 5, verses 39 and 40, Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, and he says to them, "You search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life, and it is they that bear witness about me, and yet you refuse to come to me that you may have life." Now, Jesus is, of course, speaking in these verses about the Old Testament, and he says to the Pharisees, like, "Man, you guys just pore over the Old Testament thinking that you're going to find life in it, but you don't even realize that the Old Testament is about me." Right? He says the Old Testament is about Jesus. And it's very clear to see in Genesis 37 how it's about Jesus. The father, Jacob, has concern for his wayward children. So he sends his son. But his own brothers don't receive him. They reject him. And he suffers violence. But in the end, God uses that rejection and he uses that violence to bring about life. Now in Genesis 37, Joseph doesn't know how the story is going to end. He doesn't know how bad things really were. And he doesn't know where God is going to take the story. All he can see is the inside of the cistern. But we, with thousands of years of hindsight, and we have the story before us, and we know where it goes, and we know chapter 50, we can have a Genesis 50 perspective, and we can see how God was using all of these events in Joseph's life to bring about life, not only for him, but for all of the people of Israel, for his whole family. Now, similarly, God has a Genesis 50 perspective on our life. He knows how it's going to end. And honestly, so do we. The book of Revelation tells us it ends with the dwelling place of God being with people. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore. For the former things have passed away. So now, as we remember acts of evil, acts of violence, a body broken, blood poured out, can we, by faith, have a Genesis 50 perspective on what's going on in our lives? Can we believe that God uses even tragedy to bring about life? Now, that doesn't mean that we rejoice in evil. That doesn't mean that we just, you know, just suck it up. No, we call evil what it is. We call evil, evil. But it also means that we recognize that not even evil can thwart the plans of God. That God can use evil to bring about his purposes. And we affirm, even in the cistern, that God meant it for good.